From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mona Sharon doesn't stand down from controversy. She thinks America should go to war with Iraq, and she's been making the case in her syndicated column. Today, she took aim at the argument that war doesn't solve anything. How about the end of Nazism, she countered, or the Civil War in other columns? Sharon has been serving up stinging criticism of war protesters. Quote, we see demonstrators once again taking to the streets to denounce not Mr. Hussein's thuggery, says Sharon, but the United States for standing up to it. And she's fired off her heaviest artillery at liberals. The American left, Sharon argues, has been dead wrong time and again, wrong about the Cold War, the nuclear freeze, and now dead wrong and full of wishful thinking about Saddam. Is the debate over this war a left-right debate? Is Mona Sharon telling it like it is, or just plain old warmongering? This mother of three says she's for war. Are you as clear in your convictions? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Great Falls, Virginia, is Mona Sharon, syndicated columnist, political commentator, and author of the new book, Useful Idiots, How Liberals Got It Wrong in the Cold War and Still Blame America First. Good evening, and welcome, Mona Sharon.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Thanks for joining us tonight. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Hello.
Mona Sharon, we're going to look at Iraq. We see your March 3rd column. You say, I'm for war. But before we get there, the big thesis that you've got out on the table at the moment is that the American left has been wrong, on the wrong side of virtually every major foreign policy question of the 20th century, and that it's about to be or is on the wrong side of the war with Iraq. Make that case.
Well, one correction. I didn't say they were on the wrong side of every issue in the 20th century, but I did say they were on the wrong side of every foreign policy question since around 1966, when they decamped from the anti-communist team and decided that not only was communism not worth fighting, but that we might, in fact, be on the wrong side of that struggle. That was what the Vietnam War debate turned into. I make the case in Useful Idiots that liberalism really became leftism in around that period during the Vietnam War. Before that, liberals had been, liberal internationalism had been the established foreign policy of the country. And part of what that meant was opposition to tyranny, and part of what that meant was opposition to communism, just as we had vigorously opposed the Nazis. John F. Kennedy, a liberal, was the author of the most famous and inspiring anti-communist message probably of the 20th century. That we would bear any burden and oppose any foe and support any friend to ensure the survival of liberty. That was an anti-communist siren song, really.
But it's not about anti-communism anymore, yet you're drawing the left-right divide into the Iraq war debate. Why?
Well, I think the habits of mind that began during the Vietnam War grew to characterize the left in general and its approach, and liberals and their approach to foreign affairs. It has hardened into a view that if there is trouble in the world, it is probably the fault of the United States, that we are always causing trouble rather than being the solution, that other countries deserve more respect, really, than we do, that their needs should take precedence. And again and again, you've seen, even since September 11th, the response of liberals was, well, what have we done to make them hate us so much? The other aspect of this is that during Vietnam and since, liberals have adopted a very jaundiced view of the United States itself and have come to think that our whole contribution to world history is, they don't see our contribution to world history. What they see instead is all of our faults and all of our flaws. Now, we do have them, no question, but to see American history as only the story of, for example, the treatment of blacks or the treatment of American Indians, and not also as the glorious triumph of liberty, is to give a very, it's really not to have your head screwed on right, in my opinion. opinion.
Mona Sharon, there's so much to dig into here, and we will. You write in your book, Christian Doctrine to One Side, you say the world is a fallen place, a roiling, corrupt, unstable, vicious, and unpredictable place, at least in many places. Absent American leadership and strength of mind during the 20th century, it could have been infinitely worse. We recognize, I mean, useful idiots as the kind of phrase that's it's part of, I don't know, of slam-bam television, right-left confrontation. Martial morons, useful idiots. What's the point of the phrase?
No, it's Lenin's phrase. In the early 1920s.
And the title of your book, we note.
It is, right. And in the early 1920s, Vladimir Lenin predicted that in response to the Soviet challenge, liberals and leftists would prove themselves to be useful idiots for the Soviets, that they would have, that either through credulity or naivete, that they would give the Soviets every benefit of the doubt and call down the harshest possible judgment on their own countries, and that's exactly what happened.
But you talk about hardened views and wishful thinking, and left-right aside, and I think almost entirely aside, because there really isn't a, if we think of that as an issue of communism or anti-communism, that's simply not a factor here. There's some very cold-eyed critiques. Well, maybe in legacy, but what about the very cold-eyed critiques that are concerned about wishful thinking on the part of folks who think that war is going to be a solution, that we're going to have a democratic carpet rolled across the Middle East, about hardened views that see a military response as the right surgical tool when maybe it's not?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, it just seems to me that this is a door that might swing two ways. Once we, if we take the ideology out of it, are you so perfectly confident that the wishful thinking is so loaded on one side?
I see. Okay. Well, that's a fair question. Obviously, whenever you undertake war, you do so cautiously, and I think George Bush has done it very cautiously. It's fraught with uncertainty. Who knows what unpleasant surprises might await our troops or even our homeland as a result of this war. That's true. But you also have to take into account, and this is what I think so many leftists fail to do, that peace at any price is definitely not worth having. That sometimes the only alternative is war, because it is better, as Churchill said, to fight than to live as slaves. Not that that's the alternative we face, but in this case, what we face is either dealing with a problem when it is manageable or waiting until it becomes highly dangerous for us, and then we will have even fewer choices. And there is no question that leaving Saddam Hussein in power would be very, very foolish from the point of view of the national interests of this country and the region.
Mona Sharon, does it give you any pause when you see libertarians who wouldn't have been associated with liberals stepping up and voicing their own concerns about the direction of the war on terrorism, United States policy on civil liberties, and maybe even the consequences of war for the domestic, for the home front? Are these odd bedfellows in your view? Does it make you think twice as a conservative about your analysis?
Well, no. Libertarians tend to take an extremely narrow view of the role of government, and that's why I'm not a libertarian. I think if they could privatize, howitzers and tanks and aircraft carriers, they would. But obviously, you can't do that, in the real world, nor should you want to. There are certain things that nation states ought to do and do. So the fact that libertarians are critical doesn't move me particularly.
Jack Beatty, join us here. You and I have been talking through these issues since right after September 11th, and there was, for days, weeks, maybe months, a kind of an end to the left-right conversation. Mona Sharon has got it back here, front and center, tying a thread and more between much of a century of politics and where people stand on the Iraq War. Is this the right framework in which to see and debate this war?
I don't know how useful it is, really. I mean, just at the empirical level, Tom Friedman is certainly a liberal columnist. He seems to be for the war, or was until yesterday. The New Republic, strongly for the war. On the other hand, Pat Buchanan, a critic of it. Jack Kemp, critic of it, Republican vice presidential candidate. The situation, I think, is a good deal murkier than simply some left-right split. And moreover, just this, these unwanted generalizations, leftist, liberal. I mean, this is there's no answering such a charge, since it's a kind of bag for all the things Ms. Sharon doesn't like. I mean, liberals disagree about lots of things, but I think what there is a commonality here is that the liberal temper thinks that America's strength lies more in its institutions. It lies more in America as an example to the world. It lies in our Constitution. It lies in our liberties. It lies in our values, not in our military prowess. Our prowess can support that. But I think liberals are always aware of the degree to which our hard power can undermine the suasive and ultimately, corrosive on tyranny effects of our soft power, of the propaganda of the good life in America and of American liberty. So I think there is, I do think people on the right believe in force much more and much less in the efficacy of our soft power to get our way in the world.
You want to share too quick for the hard power lever here?
Oh, no. I actually don't disagree with Jack Beatty. I'm not going to attempt to speak for all conservatives because, as you know, there are lots of different views on the right, just as there are on the left, yeah. Although I do think it's a fair generalization to say that most people on the left oppose this war and most people on the right support it. And in fact, polls reflect that. But, for example, 34% of Democratic women, only 34% of Democratic women support the war in Iraq. Whereas,
the sharp difference is Republican and Democrat,
yes,
no question
yes,
about it.
Okay. But in terms of the soft versus hard power of the United States, I think that we need to pay attention to the soft power. I think that focusing on America's message to the world, which is one of liberty, order, rule of law, tolerance, diversity, all of those things, I think is a very, very powerful message. And I think it ought to be one that we are unabashedly and unashamedly promoting around the world. I think it's what most people on the planet want for themselves if they don't already have it. And the problem is you can't rely on that all by itself when you're dealing with somebody like Saddam Hussein or Al-Qaeda. I mean, there are places and times when only hard power will do.
But you've seen the kind of opposition that plans for war have engendered around the world. Does that mean that the specter of military intervention is overshadowing, driving out those soft messages,
well,
those positive messages?
Part of the reason that we have a sense of world opposition is an artifact of the creation of the United Nations, which gives an a disproportionate voice to France and Germany, France and Russia.
But you can take the tally right down to the UN membership, or you can take a tally right down to the UN membership and find a pretty heavy preponderance opposed to war.
Right, but among the democracies, we have widespread support, and France notwithstanding.
I'm not sure that's so evident, Sharon, at the moment.
Well,
we can agree to disagree.
Something like three dozen countries that are supporting us.
It's not that there aren't any, but if you want to look at numbers and look at some that really matter, democracies like Turkey.
Well, Turkey, I think the jury is still out there, and there are complex reasons for that, mostly having to do with the fact that we left them in the lurch in 1991, by not finishing off Saddam at the time and costing them and their economy billions. Which they suffered throughout the decade of the 1990s.
But this bottom-line question of the military face driving out or shading the positive face,
well, look,
the attractive face.
I actually don't think so. I think that if you have a very drawn-out and tentative build-up to war as we have had, you do open yourself up to criticism and carping from everybody. And, Colin Powell was determined that we were going to take the pulse of Cameroon and Ethiopia and everybody else before we went to war in our own self-interest. Okay, so now we've done that, and everybody is giving us their views, whereas, of course, they would never ask for our views before doing what they thought was in their national interest.
Mona Sharon, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. We're talking with conservative columnist Mona Sharon about war and liberals, why she's ready for war with Iraq, why she thinks liberals are not. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with conservative columnist Mona Sharon about war and liberals, why she's ready for war with Iraq, why she thinks liberals are not. You can join the conversation. After American Revolution, Civil War, and Hitler's defeat, should liberals admit some good can come from war? Can good come from this war? And is framing debate over this war as a left-right fight a way of ducking real issues? Or does it go to the heart of the matter? Who's operating under illusions here, the war hawks or the peace doves? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. David's calling from Medfield, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I really think your guest has just really got things confused, and that the first thing that the United States, I think, should be purporting to the rest of the world is showing off its integrity and its belief in rules of law and its restraint. It's got this tremendous, tremendous power, more than any other nation has ever had, and I think that deserves a lot of constraint. Now, you may argue that we've already shown constraint by going to the UN, but we really have to work within that framework. We can't just start saying to everybody, if we don't agree with some treaty that we signed, that we're going to, you know, pull out of it or ignore it and then go ahead with our own.
Is that a left-right issue in your mind, David?
And it's not a left-right issue. I think, and, you know, first of all, I'm a very liberal person, and I hate that label leftist. It's just garbage from the 50s. And the thing is that, you know, I think most people on the left, if you want to say on the left, would say they're in favor of this war, but only under certain conditions. There's a great mistrust of the government. There's a great mistrust of the evidence. And if we had the evidence and we go through the correct channels, then I think almost everyone would be in favor of it.
You
so
know
I don't
what,
think
sir?
It's
a
Mona Sharon.
You don't need the federal government to give you the evidence that you need. Read the New Yorker. Read the New Yorker. Read the New Yorker magazine. Read the reports of Jeff Goldberg about what goes on in Iraq.
Why on earth should I trust George Bush to tell me the truth?
I'm not asking you to rely on George Bush. I'm asking
you
to rely on independent journalists. The New Yorker is hardly an organ of the federal government.
I'm going to let the New Yorker decide for me whether I should go to war or not?
Well, there are lots of other outlets, sir.
Come on, that's silly.
You don't trust the labor government?
Mona Sharon, to the larger point, are you full and well satisfied that the evidence is there, that this is you know the pillars of this, and it's interesting to me in your columns, you kind of blow by the weapons of mass destruction argument, the terror link argument, and you say, at bottom, this is about getting Saddam Hussein out of there.
No, I don't. Sorry, I don't. That's not what
I'll try and sort through while we talk here, but that was...
No. What I said was, in one of my columns, and this may be what gave you that impression, I said that even without those arguments, which are the most compelling arguments for doing something about him, the humanitarian case standing all by itself would be almost compelling enough, maybe for some people like me, compelling enough to go to war. But it is married to these other things like the pursuit of weapons of mass destruction, his history of attacking his neighbors, three of them in the 20 years that he has been in power. The willingness to use those weapons of mass destruction. He is responsible for the deaths of 1.2 million people. That is a record that no other modern despot can match.
So are we going to go after despots one after another in order of the number of people that they...
That might not be a bad use for an international cop in an ideal world. But no, we're not going to do that because we have to take into account that our soldiers are being put at risk. And it's unfair to ask Americans to offer up their lives and sacrifice if it doesn't involve the national security interests of the United States. Mm. But in the case of Iraq, it does.
We'll come back and look at the evidence issue. But what about David's complaint saying, hey, lay off the leftist thing. That's history. The Cold War is over.
Well,
it's a new era. Liberal is back closer to its original meaning.
I don't blame him for not wanting to go over that history. It's highly embarrassing to liberals. That history includes having apologized for, excused, overlooked the crimes of the most criminal regimes on the planet, always making excuses for them, believing that people like Castro were basically benevolent, welcoming the advent of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, you know, constantly urging that we get over our inordinate fear of communism in Jimmy Carter's memorable phrase, and on and on. They were dead wrong about all of it. I quote William Shawcross in my book, who was one of the only liberals who was honest enough after the end of the Vietnam era to say that looking at the consequences of the liberal victory, that is, we pulled out and the communists won, which is what they wanted to have it to have happen, the terrible plight of the Vietnamese, the hundreds of thousands of refugees, many of them boat people, and the horrific Holocaust in Cambodia, William Shawcross said, you know, I was all too inclined during the war as a war correspondent to believe the worst about the American side and to downplay or minimize the evil of the enemy we were facing. And he said he regretted that. But he was one of the only voices to say so.
Of course, William Shawcross was one of those who exposed the secret bombing of Cambodia and who at the time and later argued that that bombing had a lot to do with setting the concatenation of events rolling that led to the Khmer Rouge taking power in Cambodia that led to the genocide.
And
your spiel about liberals, you know, siding up to all these wicked people and justifying these murders, are you saying that the Vietnam War should have gone on? That we should have added to the 6,000 dead Americans and the 2 million dead Vietnamese. Has Vietnam done a single thing to hurt this country since then?
I'll answer.
Has Vietnam harmed a single American?
But you have to stop ranting if you want me to answer your question. Okay?
Well, after listening to this spillover of wild charge, I don't know how else I can respond.
Okay. Well, here's my answer.
Good.
Reasonable people could have differed about whether Vietnam was a prudent use of American power and manpower at the time. You could have made a case, and some people did in very moderate terms, that this was not that prudentially this was not the right way and place for America to try to thwart the spread of world communism. But that is not the way the debate was framed. It was framed as, we were an aggressor, that we were a criminal nation, that our troops were committing atrocities. Hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? Et cetera, et cetera. It was framed as the valiant Viet Cong versus the ugly American. And I don't think that looking back on that, you would deny that that's the way it has come down to us in history. That's what most people think.
Well, there was a fairly strange framing on the conservative side as well when you look at that war.
In what sense?
Well, let's take domino theory. I mean, you know, we got a new domino theory set up now, but I don't know if it's more effective than the last.
Well, no. I mean, the domino theory, you're quite right, turned out to be incorrect. But it does not invalidate the cause of thwarting the spread of communism, which was a moral and wise policy.
Jack, I don't want to beat Vietnam to death on this night of all nights. Maybe a week before war in the year 2003, we hear Mona Sharon's point. You know, take it or leave it, and I hear you leaving it. But what about this issue of who are the realists now? You know, I asked Mona earlier about where the wishful thinking lies now. In your view, Jack, we've got if we buy that we've got colliding worldviews here, where do you see the greater firmness of realism?
Well, I've never heard such an expression of Wilsonian idealism as has been coming out of the Republican right from the president recently at the American Enterprise Institute, talking of here's how we will deal with the Israel-Palestine question. We will create a democracy in Iraq. That will somehow, the phrase we've used is, there'll be a tsunami of democracy that'll just spread across the Middle East, and no one will say imperialism, no one will say colonialism, all they'll think is democracy. I've never heard such a wild sort of surmise, a postulation of possibilities that if a leftist had come up with this sort of let's remake the world idea, the right wing would say, you are dreaming. This is the kind of thing that liberals do all the time. They want to redeem history. Boy, we got to take it like it is and as it is. This aspect of Bushism, it seems to me, is wishful thinking to the 10th power.
Mona Sharon?
So what would you do? Rather than remove the serpent and put in his place a democratic at least the beginnings of a democratic Iraq. We can't expect miracles, of course, but we can set the stage. By the way, nobody thought Japan or Germany were fertile fields for democracy after the Second World War either, and they had reasons for their pessimism, ample historical cause. So what would you do? You would sit by and try to do nothing to reform the Arab world, which is the seedbed of so much of the terror that we face?
Jack?
The Arab world will have to reach its own reformation. It isn't up to Western arms to create the conditions of reform in the Arab world. Unfortunately, and of course here's where the apples and oranges with Germany and Japan, unfortunately, and not because America has necessarily been the perpetrator of this, we come to this world with centuries of Western imperialism grooving us as the enemy. And the phrase even democratic imperialism that you've been hearing a lot lately is a kind of oxymoron, because to people in the region, the democratic part will bear the onus of the imperialist part. And then, of course, if this were just happening in a vacuum, you could say, well, maybe that's the way it could work. But it's not. We have another enemy, Al-Qaeda. And here's where the realists, it seems to me, are on much sounder footing, who say, let's deal with that enemy. Let's keep this guy in his box. Let's contain him. And let's make sure we tamp out any possibility of this war on civilizations, which is exactly what Osama bin Laden wants.
And Jack Beattie, Mona Sharon, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to turn to them. We're talking with conservative columnist Mona Sharon about war and liberals, why she's ready for war with Iraq, and why she thinks liberals are not. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Wes is calling from Boston. Hi, Wes. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm Ms. Sharon. I'm calling because I get the sense that Ms. Sharon kind of misunderstands the source of the opposition of people to the Iraq war. I mean, I think most of us are proud of American, spread of American democracy through the 20th century. Most of us did support the war in Afghanistan, and most of us don't generally oppose war. It's just that we oppose this particular war for practical reasons. We're concerned about an offensive war with shock and awe in the first 3 days, inflaming the Muslim world, boosting recruits for Al-Qaeda, ignoring North Korea, which is a bigger threat. And frankly, my opposition to the Iraq war has mostly been formed by conservatives like Chuck Hagel, Dick Armey, Brent Scowcroft, by generals like Anthony Zinni, Norman Schwarzkopf, Wesley Clark. I mean, these are conservative, hard-nosed people who've raised practical concerns. It's not a liberal argument against the war. It's a practical argument.
Mona Sharon?
Well, 2 points. The notion of the Arab street rising up against us and more recruits for Al-Qaeda has been said over and over again. It was said that this would be the consequence, by the way, of going into Afghanistan. And nothing like that happened. But do you remember all the predictions about the thousands and thousands of new recruits that Al-Qaeda would get because our aggressive action would inspire them?
Well, I don't know exactly what we know about the level of Al-Qaeda recruiting right now.
It looks like it had the opposite effect. You know, people tend to underestimate the value of victory. It can be very invigorating for your own side and quite demoralizing for the enemy.
You quote Osama bin Laden on that, saying, people see a strong horse and a weak horse, they will naturally prefer the strong horse.
Well, that's the only thing that Osama bin Laden has ever said that I think is true. he was, of course, assuming that he is the strong horse and we are the weak one, and I was saying that we need to persuade him and those who might be inclined in his direction because they believe he is strong.
But one of Wes's points, you go on to write, when we overthrow Saddam and continue to roll up the leadership of Al-Qaeda, many of those in the Muslim world will slip their jihad notebooks into a bottom drawer. Are you so confident of that? Jack and Wes have the active concern that instead we'll see fire of anger spreading, that this becomes the recruiting sergeant for a new generation of terrorists.
It did not happen that way. After the Gulf War, it didn't happen that way after Afghanistan. I do not expect it to happen now. And in fact, I do believe, Mr. Beattie, notwithstanding, that Iraq is capable of democracy and that the beneficial message the message of hope, really, that would send to the rest of the Arab world would be quite revolutionary for that part of the world. Some of those people are not democracies because they don't want to be, but some of them aren't because they're repressed and they have dictatorial regimes, and they believe there's no other way.
And what about Wes's checklist of conservatives and former military generals who have expressed practical opposition on practical grounds to this war now?
What sort of practical grounds?
Well, I can ask Wes to speak to that, but Dick Armey has had his complaints. So Wesley Clark has.
Well, Dick Armey changed his mind. He completely changed his mind. I don't know what practical concerns Wes was listing. The fact
Wes,
is
are you there?
Military.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yes. Do you want to speak to that, Wes?
Yeah. The ones that I was referring to they don't like to lump Afghanistan and Iraq together. I mean, agree with Ms. Sharon that the dire predictions about Afghanistan didn't come true. But in Iraq, there's an offensive war. There, it looks to be, an occupation to get the oil. And the perception is going to be a lot different in the Muslim world. And I just think that, when you...
But we're not going to...
We were attacked by al-Qaeda on September 11th.
Wes.
And I think many people thought the response was justified. I'm just trying to finish up my point.
Okay.
These were things that Scowcroft, Schwarzkopf, Zinni... Chuck Hoggle, Nebraska. I mean, he has said some of those convincing things that I've heard against the war.
Okay, but just by appealing, I mean, there's a saying in debating that the appeal to authority is not persuasive. The fact that some of these people oppose the war is not persuasive. The substance of their arguments might be, but the
these are men presumably that you have had respect for. We don't have
I don't want to get into the personalities, though, but I will discuss the issues. The fact that some ignorant people around the world are letting themselves believe that either George Bush is just redeeming his father's reputation or he's just in it so that we can extract the oil from Iraq. I mean, in very short order, whoever thought that is going to see that, not the first point, because that's you can't prove that one way or the other. But the second point, we're not going to take their oil. If we wanted oil, if that was what this is about, we would have taken Saudi Arabia 10 years ago. It's nonsense. And it will be shown to be nonsense because we won't take the oil. And so, that argument just evaporates.
Wes, thanks for your call. Jack, it does get interesting when the arguments over realism are so spread around the ideological spectrum here.
Well, they certainly are, and military men have made these questions, and certainly people like Brent Scowcroft, he's absolutely right about that, Wes is. But, on the issue of oil, today in CNN, the government says that Iraq has put bombs. They're going to blow up the oil at Kirkuk, and they're setting explosions in the south. This gets us close to what this war is going to cost us here. We had William Nordhaus, the Yale economist, on our show who did various estimates of what the war could cost. And one of his scenarios involved just this contingency of an oil shock and the blowing up of oil of the oil wells and what that could cost. And his estimate of what it could cost us over a decade, the whole thing, if it goes that badly, approaches $2 trillion. Now, Americans have to ask themselves, what is this worth to them to get rid of Saddam Hussein?
$2 trillion is a lot of money. We're talking tonight with conservative columnist Mona Sharon. This mother of three says she's ready for war. Are you as clear in your position? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with conservative columnist Mona Sharon about war and liberals, why she's ready for war with Iraq, why she thinks liberals are not the question for you. Is this debate over war with Iraq properly a left-right question? And if it is, who's engaged in wishful thinking here, the left or the right? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Michael's calling from Watertown. Mona Sharon. Yes, I hear you.
Just one point.
Sure.
In response to what Jack Beatty was saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is a cost to war, and it's hard to predict what that cost will be. There are disasters that could happen, or it could go very well. We don't know, but there is an extreme cost to doing nothing, and that is something that Churchill tried to persuade his countrymen of in the 1930s unsuccessfully.
But is nothing really what's being proposed in opposition here, or do you think that monitoring amounts to nothing?
Oh, it amounts to absolutely nothing. I mean, the sanctions regime itself was completely in tatters by the end of the 1990s with the Russians and the French violating it freely, Jordanians violating it. I mean, this notion that he was being well-contained and kept in his box is absolutely not true.
He was
developing weapons of mass destruction. He will get a nuclear bomb if we do not engage in this war.
Let me keep our caller, Michael, waiting for a moment, and Jack, turn this back to them, because this, in a way, is the
the nub of Mona Sharon's argument. She writes, the war with Iraq is first and foremost a war to prevent a reckless and insanely cruel dictator from acquiring the nuclear weapons he avidly seeks and which would make him invulnerable. As more than a decade of resolutions, reproaches, and failed diplomacy have demonstrated, there is no way, short of war, to remove Mr. Hussein or coax him into civilized behavior. Your response?
Well, she says he hasn't been contained. He's been contained for a decade. He hasn't done anything. Our State Department even reported, I think, just a year and a half ago, that there'd even been no evidence of any sponsorship of terrorism. So he's done nothing. And
that's
as to the
not
claim,
true.
And as to the claims about weapons of mass destruction, well, as our caller David raised, there are all kinds of evidential problems. First of all, you've got the fact that the inspectors haven't found anything. Second, you've got the forged documents that alleged to make the uranium connection. You've got the U.S. spin on the aluminum tubes, which El Baradei, whom I would take any day as an authority over the spinners in the administration, says are not for nuclear weapons. You've got the poison factory that when the reporters went to it 2 days later, they found, well, there wasn't any running water, there wasn't any electricity, could have been a poison factory. You've got the magnets. You've on and on and on. You've got the British government using plagiarized and dated material to make assertions about today. The propaganda campaign here.
For one of thousands of facts, it doesn't invalidate the whole document. That's a laugh. Look, Mr. Beatty, I'm sorry to say this, but I think you're living in a fantasy world. You don't want to take action, and therefore you're choosing not to believe the evidence that is before everyone's eyes.
But there's been an awful lot of criticism and skepticism about that evidence, Mona Sharon.
Well, there ought not to be. I mean, if there is anything that is obvious, it is that Saddam Hussein is a vicious tyrant who is working as hard as he possibly can to get weapons of mass destruction. If you don't believe this administration, perhaps you believed the Clinton administration, which said exactly the same thing. Perhaps you would believe the numerous international human rights organizations that have discussed his gassing of the Kurds. Perhaps you would believe other sources. You don't have to take the word of the Bush administration. But for heaven's sake, for you to sit here and say there isn't enough evidence is really, I think it's just, it doesn't pass the reasonableness test. Everybody knows he has these weapons and is seeking them avidly, including nuclear weapons. Look at all the testimony of defectors. Look at what the intelligence agencies have found.
But what about Mohammed El Baradei saying, look, we don't find evidence of this and we can monitor and keep this under control? Is that just...
No. First of all, the inspectors, as the President and Secretary of State have been tirelessly saying, were not there to seek out and discover.
Well, that's a different question. This is a fairly well-respected international Atomic Energy Agency inspector saying, we see what they've got on the nuclear front. It doesn't amount to a nuclear weapons program.
The International Atomic Energy Agency may be respected by some people, but, you know, it doesn't have a perfect track record
by
any means. It certified the North Koreans as being in compliance when we know that they were not, and so on.
And had a few problems even in Iraq. But let me turn to the long-waiting Michael calling from Watertown. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. Often from conservatives, when it comes to a problem like there being hungry people or, you know, people who, as Flanders once said, are just too lazy to work, or black people who are unfairly struck off the rolls in Florida, they'll say, well, you have to respect authority, you have to respect institutions and process and not just right wrongs. And quite frankly, I think that there's a similar argument here. It's not the proper place of the United States to decide what's right, what's wrong, what's a threat to the world, and then enforce its will. Any nation that does that will inevitably end up going for its own national interest against other nations' interests. And it would be better served, Ms. Charon, if there were some sort of international structure by which there could be some sort of agreement. No, say this man is a monster, or this nation is doing something dangerous. Let's do something about it. Or even at the very least, two-thirds of the Senate signing a declaration of war. I'm just saying that without laws made by someone else, a cop is just a vigilante. It would be better if we were the world's policemen rather than just deciding that we know what's right, and everyone else will live with it because we have the power to enforce it.
Well, Sharon, how about it?
Well, look, this is the liberal fantasy, that there could be a disinterested body, international body, which would decide in its wisdom how to dispense justice and how to resolve disputes.
Well, we
so
do
forth.
It nationally in a union of states with a lot of
That's
states'
correct,
rights.
But we are legitimate. We elect our leaders. The UN is a collection of different kinds of countries. Some are democratic. Many are autocratic.
Is the alternative in this era American imperialism?
It's not imperialism, for heaven's sake. Luckily,
well,
the nation
Well, describe it as you
has,
will. But is it American strong?
Colonies? Excuse me, where are our colonies if we're an empire?
Well, you know, there's quite a long argument about that, about influence. And I'm not trying to tag some old history on this, but simply ask you the question, does that mean, if it's not the UN, do you then see the U.S. as having to be that global cop? And do you have any fear about the vigilante
no.
aspect potential there coming to the fore with
no.
that power?
Well, first of all, I trust this country to make good and humane decisions, which I think most liberals don't. As this man said, he's worried about our vigilanteism in the world, which is really amazing when you consider the threats that are out there, and he's worried about us. But in the second place, I think it just happens to be the good fortune of the planet at this moment that the nation that has the most power, and by the way, I challenge anybody to name me a country that has had as much power as we have and has used it as benevolently, it just happens to be the world's good fortune and our own that the nation that has the most weapons is also the most benevolent and the least aggressive country on the planet. And so I will not willingly cede authority over matters of war and peace or matters of security. I believe that Saddam will give weapons of mass destruction to terrorists someday if he can. I will not cede that authority to places like Chad or Mongolia or even France.
Michael, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, what about this? This comes down to the heart of Mona Sharon's argument in a way. She calls the United States the most benevolent country on the planet. Do you accept that? And if not, what does it mean about where we're headed when it's certainly the most powerful country on the planet?
Well, I don't accept that. I mean, it's a sort of statement that comes out of patriotic identification with the country and not necessarily out of looking at the pros and cons. The fact is that power and goodness, power and virtue really comport with one another at the highest levels, and that often, indeed, power cometh before a fall for a nation. And what I terribly fear is that our power will force us to do things that really bring our benevolence into question and then undercut any benevolent effect we can have. We're about to launch on the first 48 hours 3,000 missiles and bombs on Iraq. And I think Jimmy Carter in yesterday's Times makes the very good point that this just, you know, how does this fit the just war idea when the violence is so out of proportion to any injury we have suffered from that country? We have suffered none thus far. And that the war, to be just, can only be fought as a last resort without any other, that there's no other thing you can do. There are so many other things we could do.
Let me give the last word to Mona Sharon. We've only got 20 seconds. I apologize, Mona Sharon, but your final thought on where we're headed.
Jack Beatty says there are so many other things we could do. I would suggest we've done them all, and that this is the last resort and that there is a time for war, but that fortunately good can come out of it and will come out of it. The reason that for the overwhelming force is to make the war as short as possible. That's the reason, and that's a good reason to go in strong at the beginning.
Mona Sharon, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Mona Sharon is syndicated columnist, political commentator, and author of the new book, Useful Idiots, How Liberals Got It Wrong in the Cold War and Still Blame America First. You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onepointradio.org. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
In a moment, drawing lessons from Dwight Eisenhower 50 years on. This is On Point. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. 50 years ago, next month, President Dwight Eisenhower uttered those words in his Chance for Peace address, which previewed how the recently elected president would handle the Cold War. Last night at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston, Susan Eisenhower, Ike's granddaughter and a political consultant, reflected on the 34th president's worldview and its relevance to American foreign policy today. In this excerpt, Susan Eisenhower recalls the five principles her grandfather spelled out in the Chance for Peace address that he said should always govern America's conduct in world affairs.
He outlined five major precepts of American values. And I'd like to read them to you today because we are still dealing with these issues. Whether or not the administration has adhered to the same five is another question you can judge for yourself. The point is, this presidency, these decisions, these strategies are in some ways as relevant today as they were then. Eisenhower was planning for a long struggle. He was desperately worried that the United States would undergo enormous economic strain in trying to meet the challenge. He was determined that, in the end, our way of life, our democracy, our liberty, our economic solvency would be as much an inspiration to those who countered us as any threat of force. And so in giving this speech on April 16th, he said, "The way chosen by the United States was plainly marked by a few precepts which govern its conduct in world affairs." This is Eisenhower talking now. First, no people on earth can be held as a people to be an enemy, for all humanity shares the common hunger for peace, fellowship, and justice. Second, no nation's security and well-being can be lastingly achieved in isolation, but only in effective cooperation with fellow nations. Third, every nation's right to form a government and an economic system of its own choosing is inalienable. Fourth, any nation's attempt to dictate to other nations their form of government is indefensible. Fifth, a nation's hope of lasting peace cannot be firmly based upon any race and armaments, but rather upon just relations and honest understanding with all other nations. And then he concluded in his speech that the Soviet Union had a number of steps that it could take to build the kind of confidence for the long haul. In closing, I would say that the Eisenhower confronted and managed many challenges. He believed deeply in the importance of a strong alliance and actually made concessions to keep our allies with us at the most important and crucial times. He believed in the enormous importance of winning the hearts and minds of those who opposed us. And in doing so, he established the United States Information Agency and fostered programs like People to People. In addition to a strong stand against colonialism, which he believed was the Achilles heel of the West's appeal to non-aligned nations, he believed deeply in the importance of having a well-organized government. That is, a systematic policy development process that made sure that our policy was well thought through and not a kind of freelance exercise. And so I do recommend that you go back and read some of this period because it is hauntingly relevant today. And I think we certainly at that time adopted a way forward that in the end bore fruit some many years later.
Susan Eisenhower, granddaughter of President Dwight Eisenhower, speaking last night at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.